is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board of directors, thanks for being here for what I think is going to be an excellent session to examine the quasi-governmental authorities that a number of countries, particularly Germany, the Netherlands, and France, have established in their health care systems. Now, in the reform legislation that Congress is considering, there are a number of new organizational entities, some governmental, some sort of governmental, some not, to handle a bunch of very important tasks. So we had a radical thought, especially radical in light of what some call American exceptionalism, that is, the belief that we have nothing to learn from anyone else. That is, why not look at some of the governing or advisory structures in place in other countries in areas like quality and cost containment and payment regulation? How do they work? How well do they work? How are they held accountable? And fortunately, our colleagues at the Commonwealth Fund were convening a three-day meeting that ended just moments ago, which is why we're just a couple minutes late. Bring into town representatives of many countries involved in this area of endeavor. So we drafted several of the articulate members of that group, convinced them to stay a few more hours, added a thoughtful American commentator, and voila, a great panel. Now that leads me, not too subtly, to the fact that our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing is the Commonwealth Fund, which has done more good comparative analysis among countries' health systems than anybody else I know of. And with us today representing the fund and co-moderating the discussion is Robin Osborne. Robin is the Vice President and Director of the Fund's International Program in Health Policy and Practice and has been so since 1997, a record for longevity. Robin, thank you for helping us put this together and for making sure that our panel is intact.
Great. Thanks so much, Ed. On behalf of the Commonwealth Fund, I'm delighted to join Ed and welcome you here and to thank you for joining us for this briefing. I know that I'm speaking on behalf of Karen Davis, President of the Commonwealth Fund, Steve Schoenbaum, Executive Vice President, when I say how pleased we are to be able to conduct this afternoon's international session here on Capitol Hill and to be able to share with this broad audience of Washington policymakers a look at three industrialized countries and their approaches to policymaking and governance in their system. We're particularly grateful to the Alliance, to Ed Howard, Nancy Peavy, Deanna Okrin for their collaboration in organizing this program. As many of you probably know, the Commonwealth Fund is a private foundation established in 1918 by Anna Harkness with the broad charge to enhance the common good. The mission of the Commonwealth Fund is to promote a high-performing healthcare system that achieves better access, improved quality, and greater efficiency. And in doing so, we are particularly committed to improving care for society's most vulnerable populations, the poor, the uninsured, minority Americans, young children, and the elderly. Since 1918, the Fund has conducted research and sponsored service delivery innovations aimed at helping to address many of the most urgent health policy problems in the United States. Recognizing, however, that many of the issues of greatest concern to the Fund, access to adequate primary and preventive care, quality of care, responsiveness to patients' concerns, reducing barriers to health care for vulnerable populations, long-term care, and ensuring value for money, are matters of equal concern in other industrialized countries, the Fund established an international program in health policy and practice. The core countries of the Fund's program are Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, New Zealand, Sweden, Switzerland, and the UK. The program is very much premised on the belief that despite the differences in the ways healthcare systems are organized and financed, the cultures and the political context in which they operate, there are valuable lessons to be learned and drawn when policymakers, researchers, and journalists look beyond their own borders at the experience of other countries. I think instinctively there's a conventional wisdom, and it operates in similarly in other countries, for each of us to believe that we have the best healthcare system in the world. Unpeeling that, however, what the data shows and what we've learned is that no country really is the best or the worst. Each performs well on some measures and shows room for improvement on others. And what the fund hopes to do through cross-national comparative research and exchanges, such as today's, is share country policy innovations that may be relevant to the United States. Ensuring access, improving quality of healthcare and efficiency are driving concerns in each of the countries that are represented here today. And similarly, they're concerned with the parallel theme of getting value for money. For the U.S., these themes, as we stand on the threshold of health reform, really resonate. U.S. per capita spending on health care is more than twice the OECD median. But despite outspending every other country, we often deliver poor performance. In a recent study by Nolte and McKee, published in Health Affairs, the U.S. ranked 19th, last of the 19 countries, on mortality amenable to health care. And these are the deaths that could have been prevented: bacterial infections, treatable cancers, diabetes before the age of 50. On an annual basis, the fund produces cross-national data for benchmarking and comparing U.S. healthcare system performance with other countries. In an 8-country study of chronically ill patients, and these findings are in the packs that you have and have been published in Health Affairs, patients report their healthcare experiences. The U.S. performance was at the bottom of the 8-country ranking of our 2008 study of chronically ill adults when it came to patients not being able to get needed care because of costs, inefficiency, poor coordination of care, medical errors, and hospital readmissions. Yesterday, the fund published its 2009 international survey of primary care doctors in 11 countries. Key findings, where the U.S. was an outlier, were that the majority, 58%, of U.S. doctors reported their patients have difficulty paying for medications and paying for out-of-pocket costs, compared to 5% to 37% in the other countries. And one half of U.S. doctors said that the amount of time they have to spend getting patients needed medications or treatments because of insurance restrictions is a major problem. Only 10% of primary care doctors in the Netherlands, where everyone in the healthcare system has private insurance, said this was a problem for them. The U.S. also lagged behind on after-hours care, electronic medical records, and financial incentives to improve quality. This, too, is in your pack. This afternoon, we have the opportunity to look at three high-performing OECD countries, Germany, the Netherlands, and France, and their respective approaches to policymaking and to governance. Each has undergone sweeping health reforms in the last few years that have impacted health insurance coverage and financing. Each has implemented bold provider payment reforms, including blended payments, and made increasingly innovative use of financial incentives to try and drive quality and performance. Each has tried new approaches to controlling costs and encouraging competition, and each is concerned with paying only for what works and has established entities to do comparative effective research and to use the findings to inform coverage decisions. Today's briefing will showcase the kinds of quasi-governmental authorities that Germany, the Netherlands, and France have established. These operate within broad legislative frameworks with relative independence from their respective health ministries. And these entities are designed to help control costs, oversee quality, regulate insurance and provider payments, and ensure competition. Some of them are advisory, sometimes they're regulatory authorities that can be public or private, yet nonetheless they share the aims of trying to support more evidence-based and transparent decision-making in healthcare that is at arm's length from the political process. We're privileged today to have with us three outstanding speakers, each of whom occupies senior positions in their country and can talk from very firsthand experience about these entities, and I'd like to introduce them. Dr. Karl Lauterbach is an elected member of the German Parliament, the Bundestag, where he has also served as advisor to the Federal Minister of Health and Social Security. He is as well director of the Institute of Health Economics and Clinical Epidemiology at the University of Cologne and an adjunct professor at Harvard School of Public Health. He's a health economist and expert on evidence-based medicine, managed care, and cost-effectiveness analysis. Dominique Poltan is director of strategy and research at CNAMTS, the French National Health Insurance Fund for Salaried Workers, the public health insurer covering 85% of the population that also has responsibilities for the regulation of the healthcare system. Prior to working at CNAMTS, she was director of the Institute for Research and Information in Health Economics and is a member of the French National Council for the Future of Health Insurance. Kathy van Beek is acting chair of the Executive Board of the Dutch Healthcare Authority, the NZA. Her responsibility include healthcare markets, innovation, and quality of care. Kathy van Beek has extensive managerial experience in the Dutch hospital sector, and her last position before joining NZA was chair of the Executive Board of a specialized hospital and center of excellence for orthopedic surgery, rheumatology, and rehabilitation. And lastly, we're delighted to have John Rother here as reactor on this panel to provide a U.S. perspective. John is Executive Vice President of Policy and Strategy for AARP. He's responsible for federal and state public policy and for formulating AARP's overall direction. And he is, as I think almost everyone in the room would know, nationally known authority on Medicare, managed care, and Social Security, who had served as staff for former Senator Jacob Javits and staff director and chief counsel for the Special Committee on Aging under Senator John Hartz prior to joining AARP. So with that, I'll turn over to Ed. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Robin. And I should add, with respect to Mr. Rother, that in the interest of full disclosure, and I'm happy to be able to say this for the first time as introducing him as a panelist, John now serves on the board of the Alliance for Health Reform, so we're happy to have him both helping us carry out our program and helping to shape our program. The other thing before we get started is I wonder if I could ask Othel to turn our timer right side up so we wouldn't confuse our speakers quite as much as we would otherwise. You don't have 0001 minutes to speak, Carl. A couple of logistical questions to be answered. You have the materials, as Robin said, that relate to this discussion, including most of the PowerPoints. One we received late, and you'll get it on our website, allhealth.org, as soon as we get back to the office. We'll have a webcast and a podcast available on Monday through kaisernetwork.org or through our website, and a transcript available a few days after that on our website. We'd love to have you ask questions at the conclusion of the presentations. You can do that either by going to one of the microphones or by filling out the green question card in your packets. And at the appropriate time, please fill out the blue evaluation form to help us improve these programs as we go along. So without further delay, let me turn to Karl Lauterbach, whom I think of as the German equivalent of Mark McClellan, you know, except that Mark has never been elected to Congress. Karl, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's never too late for Mark to be elected. Thank you so much for the invitation. I will first of all introduce very briefly the German system. The German healthcare system is actually a system that serves 82 million inhabitants. 72 million are covered by the public system, which we also call the statutory health insurance system, and 20% are covered by private insurance. And the higher income groups and the upper middle class can pick between the private and the public system, but the private system is not open for everyone. It is not open for very low income people, and it is not open for the unemployed. So in that sense, we do have competition between the private and the public system, but the private system is by and large only open for civil servants and for higher income people. The statutory health insurance, so the public system, dates back to 1883. It was originally only open to blue-collar workers. It had a minimum benefit catalog, and different types of sickness funds were open to different professional groups. Nowadays, the system is open for everyone. It is operating through the so-called solidarity principle. The solidarity principle means there is mandatory contracting, so contracts available for everyone. There's no surcharge for age or risk. There is a dependency of what you pay according to what you earn. So low salary, low payment. The payments are income related. Dependents of members are free and enjoy the same benefits. And there's contributions for unemployed and welfare recipients paid by public funds. So it's a system that covers by and large everyone, other than those that are in the private system, where you can opt out from the public system into the private system. It has have a highly developed infrastructure. There is no waiting lists in Germany for major services, and the system does have the common problems of all European societies. We have aging societies, low birth rates, we have very expensive innovations, and therefore we have spiraling costs. What I'm going to present today is what I consider to be the heart of the German system. The heart of the German system is the self-administration of the public system, and in this self-administration, the decisions are made what is reimbursed, on what evidence, and for what prices. So what we are basically looking here is what is the benefit package and at what cost the benefit package for society is available, and what are the prices that are reimbursed to providers. So again, the three major decisions we focus on: what is in the benefit package, why is it in the benefit package, and at what prices it is in the benefit package. There is three institutions that make these decisions on behalf of the government. The government is not involved in this decision-making process directly, but is only supervising this decision-making process. The decision-making process is made by the self-administration. Well, most important, the decision what is actually covered is made by the GBA, the Federal Joint Committee. This is a committee represented by patients, physicians, sickness funds, so basically by the payers, the providers, and the patients. This is the most important body in our self-government. This body determines what is in the basic benefit package. The services that are to be covered all have to be effective, efficient, and they have to be provided in a cost-effective way. So therefore, the system can only include services that are shown to be effective, they work, they have to be efficient, so the cost-effectiveness may not be too bad, and the services must be provided in an efficient way. So for example, a service that can easily be provided in outpatient setting will not be covered in an inpatient setting if it is way more expensive in such a setting. And these are the decision rules for which the Federal Joint Committee is responsible. The IQWiG, this is comparable to the UK NICE system, to which you may, with which you may be more familiar, is a federal research institute which evaluates medical services with regard to their effectiveness and cost effectiveness and makes recommendations to the Joint Committee. And what you see here, the Spitzenverband, the Central Federal Association of the Health Insurance Fund, this is the institution that then determines the prices, in particular whether there is reference prices or not, whether there is price ceilings, yes or no. But this institution only determines at what rate a service is covered. It does not determine whether a service is covered, yes or no. So in Germany, the sickness funds have to cover all services that were determined to be effective and efficient by this federal joint committee. It is not possible for a sickness fund, for example, to say we are not going to cover this or that service if the service passed this body. So this is the reason why this is basically the body that determines what services are covered or not. So going back to the federal joint committee, the GBA, the Federal Joint Committee is the main decision-making body in the German healthcare system. It is authorized by law to issue legally binding directives. So once a decision by this body has been made, this does have legally the status of a law. And if you, for example, as a sickness fund, do not want to cover such a service, you must legally claim against this body, and this by and large never is successful. So the directives are equivalent to law. It's a kind of a law-making body. It was established in 2004, but its predecessor goes back to the 1920s. It represents physicians, hospitals, sickness funds, and patients. The tasks include evidence-based coverage decisions regarding innovation, outpatient care, apologize for spelling mistake, hospital care. It does cover evidence-based patient information. It covers pharmaceuticals, for example, exclusion of prescription drugs, reference price setting, therapeutic advice, second opinion. It can, for example, determine that particular innovations can only be provided after a second opinion in very expensive services. And it can perform cost-effectiveness analysis, but it doesn't have to perform cost-effectiveness analysis. Also, its tasks include quality assurance. So it, for example, can give rules what type of services can be provided by specialists only and what services are also be provided by primary care physicians. It is involved in disease management programs. Disease management programs in Germany have been used to improve the quality of care for diabetes and heart disease and pulmonary disease treatments, very successful programs, which I cannot explain to you at that occasion, but those programs are based on evidence-based guidelines, and the way these guidelines are drafted is very much influenced by the GBA. And the GBA also determines what rare diseases are covered by hospitals, what outpatient treatments are covered, including psychotherapy, dentistry, orthodontics, maternal and perinatal care, prevention, screening, and many more issues. Here you see the structure of the GBA. There is an impartial and impartial chairman and two co-chairs. Then there's the sickness funds, the healthcare providers, in particular the physicians and the hospitals, and the patient representatives. And most of the decisions are ultimately made by the body in what you would call a bipartisan fashion. It is very unlikely that a position goes through which is, let's say, supported by all sickness funds but rejected by all providers. Typically, the negotiations go on and on until there is a kind of a bipartisan, there's a strong bipartisan tradition in the GBA, because the structure of the GBA depends on this bipartisan position to be held up. The GBA works in the following way. If a service is new, for example, a new way of radiation therapy, think about proton radiation therapy or something like that, then there is an application to the GBA whether this should be covered or not. This application can come from the government or from the sickness funds or from the providers. And then what typically happens is that the ICWIC, the NICE type of institution, sums up the literature, the evidence, involves the providers of the service at that point early on. So not only published data are included, but also data on record, studies on record by the providers and so forth. All available evidence is basically included. Then a report is given to the GBA. The GBA makes an appraisal and then comes up with a directive, and the directive is then turned into law by the Ministry of Health and is then published. In very rare occasions, the Minister of Health can veto a decision by the GBA, but this is rarely done, and the GBA immediately responds by taking legal veto opportunities against the Ministry. And the last two occasions we had this, I think the Ministry, as a matter of fact, lost. So this is a very complicated process. By and large, the decisions by the GBA are upheld by the social lawmakers in Germany, so don't underestimate the legal importance of the directives by the GBA at that point. The important criteria are effectiveness, whether a service is necessary or not, and whether it's efficient or not. Necessary or not means that the directives can also specify for whom the service is covered. So it's not, let's say, proton therapy, yes or no, but, for example, proton therapy for eye tumors, yes, and for solid tumors at the base of the skull, yes, but not for prostate cancer, and so forth. So if the service is necessary, if it is efficient and effective, then it is covered. But then, on the other hand, end of the table, all sickness funds have to cover the service and have to pay for the service. The institute which provides a lot of the evidence for the appraisals of the joint committee of the GBA, the ICWIC, is basically a research institute roughly employing at the moment 100 full-time employees, and the ICWIC works only on assignment. So the ICWIC does not do independent research and so forth, but it only looks into the issues that are brought to the ICWIC either by the sickness funds or by the government, so that the resources of the ICWIC are not wasted. And the way the question is phrased for the ICWIC is very important. So, for example, if the assignment is to look whether proton therapy is effective and efficient for skull tumors, that is a completely different question than, for example, look at the same issue for prostate cancer. So the assignments are very specific, and the ICWIC is only permitted to work on the very assignments in the way the assignments were done, and the whole process is very transparent. For example, there's public hearings about the issues. The data that are made available are immediately published. There's a long written justification of individual decisions, and there is standard operating procedures for almost every step in the process of making the decision. So every desk in the ICWIC is more or less governed by standard operating procedure, because so much depends on the, recommendations to the GBA of the ICWIC. And the ICWIC is obviously also a target of major legal battles, and so far the ICWIC and the GBA have survived all legal attacks by all providers, including all American drug companies that have provided that have tested their best attorneys on German ground on this one. I'm not going to name examples here. Maybe the representatives are sitting in the room, and I do not want to wear out my welcome so early. So in that sense, what you have seen here is this is the center of the German solidarity principle, because the solidarity principle only will continue to work if it continues to be payable. If it is too expensive or if there is arbitrariness in the system, it will lose its financial stability and also its support by the public. And the public support is only there because there is a fairly transparent, evidence-based decision-making process in place in which the government does not have a direct role. If all of this was done by the government, there would not be enough acceptance of the process by the population or the providers, And if it was done in a bazaar fashion, a market-type fashion, then it would never get the support by the scientists and the medical community that want to make sure that the care that is supported is also effective. So if you want to have, let's say, a working compromise, something that is accepted by the population because it is government away, and it at the same time is supported by the medical community because the decisions are more or less evidence-based, then this is a compromise we worked on in earlier reforms, and the process that you now see is in place from 2004, and it was, as a matter of fact, a bipartisan decision by the Social Democrats, the party that I represent, and the Christian Democrats, let's say middle conservatives. So it was a political bipartisan decision to come up with this process at that point, and it has been stable so far. I do finish here in, let's say, confirming rumors that us, the Social Democrats, lost the recent election, but it was not because of this decision-making process in Hesse.
I know there are some people just a few hundred yards away who feel great comfort in that. Now we turn to Kathy Van Beek.
Okay, thank you so much to be invited here. I'm very honored, special on this day, to tell you something about the healthcare authority. I would like to give you an overview of what I'm going to say. I will first speak about the need for reform in the Netherlands, which can be summarized as a combination of rising costs and market failure. Next, I will set out the basic elements of reform, the idea behind a competitive healthcare market, and the role of our healthcare authority as a market regulator. In conclusion, I would like to offer you two friendly pieces of advice. First of all, a short overview of the Dutch system, summarized in 7 key characteristics. It's essentially a market-based system with fully private health insurance and fully private health provision. There are, however, two important remarks to make. There is an overriding general consumer interest objective in the system, and this is actively pursued within the regulatory framework. This framework is characterized by full coverage of the population and a gradual or step-by-step process of price liberalization that will soon reach 50% of hospital prices. In this context, it's worth noting that in the liberalized segment, prices have so far not increased out of line with inflation. Moreover, the number of treatments has grown. Finally, we have an independent regulator that's also a sector-specific competition authority and a comprehensive system of largely ex-ante risk adjustment executed by the Healthcare Insurance Authority. I will get back to these last 2 points in detail later. I will now elaborate healthcare reform and the reasons for it. Harvard healthcare economist David Cutler has identified 3 successive waves of healthcare reform that tend to occur in developed countries. I skipped them because of the time. The increasing dissatisfaction of consumers with rationing leads to the third wave, with a movement away to more incentive-based systems, including competition. Promoting effective competition is not a goal in itself, but regarded as the best way to deliver the 3 key public policy objectives: accessibility, affordability, and quality of care. These three dimensions of the general consumer interest are our key objectives. As you can see, if you follow the blue graph, the cost of healthcare in the Netherlands is increasingly fairly rapidly and is now around 40% of the GDP. Although liberalization is not aimed at controlling costs, it is expected that increased competition will have these effects by more efficiency, more innovation, and more added value. At the same time, we shouldn't forget the benefits of healthcare. Largely, it has been money well spent, at least if you go by the associated increase in life expectancy, the pink graph. Apart from rising costs, healthcare markets are also burdened by a range of market failures. On this slide, you can see the so-called healthcare triangle between consumers, insurers, and healthcare providers, and between the markets for insurance, the market of healthcare and contracting, and healthcare provision. Next to these relevant markets, you see the main forms of market failure listed. I will not go into these in detail, but I will mention the three important aspects. First, the effect of the third-party pays principle, which means that patients are not sensitive to costs, whereas providers have obvious incentive to provide more care. There's therefore a problem of moral hazard and the expense of insurers and or the taxpayer. Second is the risk of the adverse selection, which means that insurers would prefer to insure healthy patients who never need care, whereas healthy patients have no incentive to take out insurance. This could lead to a race to the bottom, with insurers both weeding out costly consumers on the one hand and burying them at the gate on the other. Finally, I want to point out the strong position of healthcare providers, both in terms of information, there's an information asymmetry, and in the form of market power. There's reason to believe that market power of healthcare providers is pervasive in many markets, healthcare markets. All three risks are serious ones that regulation must address. What are the characteristics of the Dutch healthcare reform that was designed to counter these problems I mentioned earlier? The reform took place in 2006. It was introduced as a new legal framework that provides, in the first place, for mandatory health insurance for all Dutch citizens and a tax subsidy for those on low incomes. The counterpoint to this is universal coverage, an obligation for all health insurers to provide services to all consumers who demand them without either risk selection or premium differentiation, the so-called crown jewels of the Dutch healthcare reform. The funding regime comes in two parts. 50% of the premium is a nominal premium that is differentiated by insurer in the competitive process, but isn't different per consumer of a particular insurer. This is collected by the insurers themselves. The other 50% of the premium is income dependent and collected by the state. This part of the premium is redistributed to insurers based on the risk adjustment system. One of the main elements of the reform was this risk adjustment system. This helps avoid adverse selection and moral hazard and promotes competition on the merits. It removes the incentives to select consumers based on their health status, which is also illegal, and it promotes competition on things like quality and prevention. As you can see in this picture, the idea behind competitive healthcare markets is based on competitive insurance markets. If consumers can choose freely between competing insurers, these insurers will have incentives to put pressure on providers to improve their performance at competitive prices, competitive quality indicators, etc. And in the end, the consumer benefits. So again, the economic characteristics of the model of healthcare competition in the Netherlands are as follows. Consumers have free choice of health insurance company. There is neither risk selection nor lock-in. Switching costs are low. Competition between health insurance companies leads downwards pressure on costs. We expect the development of selective contracting with healthcare providers and directing consumers toward more efficient choices. Next, we would expect utilization review by insurers. This means cross-checking the need for treatments received as well as best practice benchmarking. So far, however, these developments are still in their infancy. Apart from the NZA, a number of other authorities are involved in healthcare regulation. For instance, there is an agency, the Healthcare Insurance Authority, which is responsible for advising or whether specific forms of care should be covered by basic insurance or not. And that is also responsible for the administration of that risk adjustment system, as I told you before. We also have a healthcare quality regulator, the Inspectorate. The Inspectorate is in charge of the quality of healthcare provision and of developing and approving healthcare standards and indicators. Apart from these healthcare-specific agencies, there is a number of other regulators that are responsible for the entire economy. And I will skip that also. To come to the role of the NZA as an independent regulator. First of all, we are responsible for the supervision and the development of three markets in healthcare triangle that I showed earlier. Secondly, we are in charge of tariff performance regulation. This means setting prices or rates and defining standard products categories which has to be used by the market participants as part of their negotiation language. Thirdly, we supervise the execution of the Health Insurance Act, of which I've already listed the key elements. Fourth and fifth, we are in charge of supervising long-term care and responsible for advising the Minister of Health, both on request and at our own initiative. I will now briefly discuss our role as a sector-specific competition authority for healthcare. So far, I have found few comparable authorities in other countries, with exception of the Cooperation and Competition Panel in the UK. This demonstrates that you can police competition even within the context of a national health service. Hopefully, this will provide inspiration for others. The objective for our supervision is the public interest. The elements I mentioned before, accessibility, affordability, and quality. In the first place, we have our own specific powers to promote effective competition. This involves, notably, our power on significant market power. in markets with dominant players. Here we can impose proportionate obligations that range from transparency and non-discrimination to accounting separation and individual price control. A prior finding of abuse is not necessary. The rationale is the protection of emerging markets as opposed to policing established markets. We can also intervene in conditions of agreement and the manner in which they are concluded. In the event of structural problems and in order to promote competition and or transparency in healthcare markets. For example, we can mandate access or strike out exclusivity clauses or impose an auction requirement for particular services. Secondly, we also cooperate closely with the General Competition Authority. This is necessary because, based on what I've just told, we have concurrent powers relating to market power and anti-competitive agreements. One important aspect of this cooperation is that the Dutch Healthcare Authority advises the Competition Authority on mergers in the healthcare sector. We are also jointly involved in the development of competition policy instruments, such as on methods of market definition, merger simulation, with significant inputs, I should add, from leading US healthcare and competition economists. Finally, we have the powers to grant state aid to struggle healthcare providers. It's clear that aid may distort competition between providers, and that distorting market exit can distort market entry. At the same time, there are public interest issues of continuity of care. The legal framework in this important area is still under construction. We are currently in process of developing our policy towards principles of minimal intervention and consistency with the EU law requirements on this regard. With this, I come to the end of my talk. I hope to have given you some idea of the Dutch healthcare system and especially of the role of the Dutch Healthcare Authority in that context. However, I still owe you the advice that I promised at the outset. Our own practice shows that healthcare reform is highly complex, and it takes a great amount of time and effort to get things at least partly right some of the time. So it is not because I believe that our system is flawless, but in the hope of sparing you unnecessary problems and complications, I offer advice for your own healthcare reforms. First, the need for an independent sectoral regulator with competition powers, especially in relation to providers with market power. But as an acting chair of the Dutch Healthcare Authority, I should say that, shouldn't I? Second, the even greater need for a comprehensive system of risk adjustment as a necessary condition for both competitive private insurance markets with full coverage and competitive markets, including the public option. You could even say, if you get this wrong, public option is likely to fail, as it will be burdened by all the risk that private insurers are seeking to avoid. But if you get it right, private insurers by themselves will compete to provide full coverage of the population. In a word, I wish you a real healthcare authority. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thanks, Kathy. We move to Dominique Poulton, and I should say that Ms. Poulton's slides are the ones that you do not have in your materials. We will have them posted on our website presently. please.
Thank you. Yes, maybe a few words to begin with. Is that okay?
Yeah.
On the French gas system. Thank you. On the French healthcare system, just in order to make sure that you have the main features, we are an insurance-based system, social insurance system, but with universal coverage. So we don't have a choice of insurers. We have affiliated according to our occupational status. But we, unlike, for instance, Germany, we've always had a very concentrated systems with three public insurers covering 96% of the population, and the first one, the fund for salaried workers and their families, alone accounts for 85% of the population. So we have a delivery of care which is a mix of public and private. We have mainly private independent physicians and other professionals in ambulatory care, and hospital care is provided both by public hospitals and private hospitals, private non-profit and private for-profit hospitals. Private for-profit hospitals, in fact, have a rather large share in France of surgery, especially elective surgery. And we have a general principle of cost-sharing, but we have a lot of exemptions, and in fact the rule is that if you are facing high expenditures, you will be better reimbursed, and this is the case, for instance, for maternity, for work injury, for occupational diseases, and also for chronic and severe illnesses. There is a list of 30 diseases with exemptions of copayments. And in addition, it's important because it has to do with what I'll say afterwards, but 92% of the population has supplementary insurance to cover co-payments, basically. The long-term trends in our system have been the following one. First, I have to do that and not on my own computer. It's important to state that our sickness funds have never had the same responsibilities as, for instance, the German sickness funds. They've never been really responsible financially. That means that if we had to raise payroll contributions, it has always been the state which has decided to do that and not the sickness funds themselves. And in fact, over time, what has happened has been we've got more and more universal. We've replaced some of the payroll contribution by taxes, earmarked taxes. And with all this, the legitimacy of sickness funds to manage the system has been challenged, and the state has taken over more and more responsibilities. Also, we've had a sort of division between sectors. The sickness funds have always been much more involved in ambulatory care, and the hospital care and drug regulation have always been on the state side. The last trend is the fact that we have been more and more strengthening the regional level. It began in 1996 with the creation of regional agencies for hospitals and also regional unions of sickness funds. But then in 2009 we had a big step towards regional health agencies. No, it's okay, I'll do that. We had two main reforms, rather important reforms in terms of governance in the last 5 years, and probably these two reforms don't go exactly the same way, but I'll talk about the one on which we have some insight, which was the 2004 reform. The second one has been just passed in Parliament, so we'll see what it gives afterwards. So the 2004 reform created three new institutions. First, a union of all the sickness funds, or at least the three main sickness funds, as you've seen, they account for almost the whole population. Then a union of private additional insurers, and third, national health authority, a national authority for health, which is the equivalent, but not exactly with, I think, the same orientations, maybe the same missions, but not exactly the same way of doing them that, as the IQWiG in Germany. What was major in this reform is that the government decided to give some autonomy to these Union of Sickness Funds to manage the system. And There was a rather broad delegation given to, for instance, negotiate with the providers. Before that, the sickness funds negotiated with the providers, but the state was always intervening afterwards to say that it didn't want the tariffs to be set like that, and it was always interfering with the negotiations. So now we are the UNCAM negotiates with all the providers in private practice, and also it has a very strong executive, the Director General of UNCAM, who has been nominated for 5 years and cannot be fired for 5 years, which is rather important to be independent from the government, really is the one to negotiate with the mandate of the three sickness funds and of the board, and of course with in the framework of orientations of the government. We don't have the legitimacy to set our own strategy. We have to be oriented by the government. But then this is his responsibility to negotiate with providers. We have other levers, such as we now manage the fee schedule, which is not quite a success because it was supposed to redistribute the money between the specialties, but it hasn't done that so far. But still, what is true, for instance, is that the first time that the radiologists have seen their income lowered by the sickness fund, we have decreased the tariffs of a certain number of procedures for radiologists and other specialties who are very, very, very who have very high incomes. And again, I think that this wouldn't have been totally possible, probably directly by the government. So this idea of putting this institution at arm's length with some powers, with some framework given by the government, but some autonomy, and with this sort of midterm vision that it had to be efficient and meet the financial targets, I think it has had some impetus on the system. I think that if you discuss with people in France, everybody will say that during the four last years, there have been a lot achieved in that respect. And if we look at the results, I mean, I will skip the list, but of innovation. But it's true that we've been through a lot of innovative programs during the last 4 years. But moreover, between 2004 and the economic downturn, which has of course changed things because we are again in deficit, but we have the growth rate of health expenditures has been the same as the growth rate of the GDP, and we have achieved a lot of efficiency programs, and some of them have been very successful. Some of them less, of course, but we're trying a lot of things, and it's a rather innovative institution. Now, the two other institutions that have been created are the National Authority for Health, so I won't talk too much about it, but basically this is the same idea than EQUIG. We need an authority which is independent from the government but from all stakeholders and gives advice on what should be in the benefit package, what is effective and efficient enough to be in the benefit package, and also has a responsibility for quality in the system. And so the National Authority for Health has in fact merged different institutions who had responsibilities, and now it's really a very broad agency with very broad responsibilities. Well, it's probably a little different, but this is the French culture from Germany, and especially from the UK with NICE, with the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, is that in France, you know, we don't like very much cost effectiveness. I mean, but it's not the only the national authority for health. It's the fact that we really believe that we can put everything in the benefit package, and it will be possible and sustainable. So we really very reluctant to have these, you know, cost effectiveness methodologies which say that such and such cancer drugs should be only for some types of patients. We are not still ready for that, but we are making progress. And I'm an economist also, which of course explains the way I think. But we have in 2007, the annual Act on Social Security has given the National Authority for Health a new responsibility, which was really to develop this cost-effective analysis more than it had done before, and to to give its advice on this basis, and not only on the basis of effectiveness, as it was before. So the last, element is a few words on the new reform, because in France we believe a lot on institutional reforms, so we're doing reforms from time to time to see whether it will get better. But what is true with this one is that we had a real problem at the regional level. We had a lot of layers of administrative bodies which had been created to do this, to do that, and everybody thought that one day we should jump to the point in merging all of these and saying that there would be somebody strong in the region to do a lot of things. And that's what we've been doing in the last law that has been passed last July. And so we now have regional health agencies, and they will be rather powerful. The people that have been, they've just been nominated, and some of them were Minister of Health before, so it's a rather high level of responsibility that is given. And the only problem, so I think it's very good, because really they will have a lot of levers at the regional level, and probably it will enhance innovation. Maybe we will test some things in the regions, in some regions, and see whether it can be extended to other regions. The only problem is that, of course, the link with the sickness fund, which remain rather national organization with a network of local offices, is still to be built. I mean, obviously, these are two directions. They're not contradictory, but they're not really consistent in a very simple way. So we still have to build this articulation. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's move to John. John, have you picked up enough that you can help those folks preparing for the vote on Saturday?
I think we've already said what we want them to do on Saturday. But what should we do about a commission? I'm sure that you are impressed, as I am, by the diversity of experience and how different European systems are from the United States. And you can't help get the feeling that maybe they're slightly ahead of us on the ability to have sophisticated regulatory guidance. I guess the first question is, why have a commission in the United States if we have CMS and we're about to have exchanges? And I think there, the perception, which I share, is that Congress isn't always the best place to make decisions that require saying no, or decisions that require a high level of complexity. And I think those are the two key justifications for something like the Independent Medicare Advisory Commission. So I think what I'll do with my time is just raise five questions that I think that the excellent presentations from our colleagues from Europe have presented us. The first one is, how broad, assuming we have a commission, that's the first question I raised. So the next part is, how broad should that commission's scope of authority be? And of course, what's amazing is that what's being proposed is something limited just to provider reimbursement, but what we're hearing from our European colleagues is a much broader range, including benefit design, quality metrics, risk adjustments, really impressive range of regulatory oversight. And it does kind of make you think that maybe we need to think about who's going to make which decisions, all of which are necessary to have a successful system. So that's the first question I would raise. The second one is, will a commission that's limited only to Medicare be successful? Because I think in each of these cases, the regulatory authority de facto extends to the entire healthcare system. And Medicare alone raises the prospect of cost shifting and dysfunction, and I think that's something that we have to really think about. The third question is, who makes up this commission? Carl mentioned in Germany that all stakeholders are represented, but the commission, as being described in the Senate Finance Bill, is a commission of experts. So which is it? Do we want this to be expertise-based, or do we want stakeholders sitting around the table working out the deal? And I thought it was extremely interesting, again, just to repeat a point that Carl made, that there are two audiences that have to accept the work of a commission. The public, and transparency is the key to that, and providers, and an evidence base, is scientific base, is key to that. So I think that's very helpful guidance to us. Fourth point is, the last point I guess I'll make, is the experience in Europe, it seems to me, is that each regulatory system started smaller and evolved over time, and you can see a kind of a step-by-step evolution. And it feels to me like we're just at the very beginning of that process. And whether or not something like an IMAC would evolve into something more robust or not, I think depends very much on how successful we are in designing it, in leading it, and implementing it over time. And those are questions that we can't answer here. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, John. We have some time for questions. We're going, I remind you, we had a different starting time, and we're going to 2:15, so we don't have to rush out of here. except for John, this is his panel day, unfortunately. We're very pleased that he squeezed us in. And let me just remind you that you have the opportunity to ask questions, to write questions, and to hear questions from our co-moderator. Robin, you want to start us off?
I just wanted to ask both Carl and Kathy if they wouldn't mind saying a few words in their systems about the role of whether it's the Federal Joint Committee or the Dutch Healthcare Authority in terms of overseeing and regulating provider payment, hospital and physician payment, and to what extent is there a cost containment role in what they're doing?
Thank you for the question. There is indirect cost containment in the joint committee, because obviously if services that are not effective or vastly inefficient are not covered, that in the long run reduces the costs of the total system and makes the system sustainable. And if these decisions are made in a wise fashion, that not only cuts costs but also is a benefit for the public. So this is like consumer protection. This is one of the reasons why the institutes are well accepted by the population, because it also protects the public against ineffective care or care that is highly inefficient. But the committee is not involved in setting prices, because I was actually involved in the law-making process many years ago when this was done. And one of the ideas that we had was we did not want to contaminate the work about effectiveness and the question for whom a service does work with the question at what prices should be offered. So therefore, all pricing decisions are made by what are called the Spitzenverband. This is the association of the sickness funds. If you merge these two questions, then there will always be a suspicion by the public that a service which is effective is deemed not to, or is called to be ineffective, because the public should be spared the financial burden. So you want to make sure that it is quite clear who is responsible for what, who determines on effectiveness of care and efficiency, and who determines prices. And we separated this quite categorically.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you for the question. As I mentioned also in my speech, the target of the healthcare authority is not to contain costs, but we expect that competition will have its effects on reducing costs. That's the one thing I like to say about it. And the other is that we do set prices or rates, and we do that kind of regulation regularly, periodically. When the prices are not free, in the hospitals in the near future we have 50% of the prices free, but the other prices we have to sustain, and we do a very large cost research. So when a provider can do the work much more efficient, then he has a profit for his own benefit. And that's not the target of the government. So we do some activities in the frame of cost containment.
Can I just clarify something? And you referred to freeing up prices in your presentation. By that you mean moving away from regulated or set prices,
yes,
into a competitive mode, is,
yes,
that right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the movement we make. And we also, perhaps I can also address some of the questions of the other person. I don't know his name exactly, I'm sorry, about how the stakeholders are involved. And we make the decisions, but we have a couple of advisory committees, and there the stakeholders are represented in. So we don't do anything without them, but we decide after consultation.
You want to comment on that one? You don't have to. If I can pick up on Carl's use of the example of comparative effectiveness, in the United States, some of the stakeholders have pointed out that when you're comparing A to B, sometimes A works better for 80% of the population and B works better for 20%. How does your system deal with subgroups that may benefit from treatments or pharmaceuticals or any other kind of intervention that are of value to some smaller subset of the population?
The decisions that are made by the GBA, by the Federal Joint Committee, take this into consideration. For example, when to use again the example of radiation therapy. Radiation therapy may have long-term consequences and may cause cancer in younger cancer survivors later on, because some of the radiation again kills one tumor but causes secondary tumors many years later. This is at least true for some forms of radiation. This will not make a difference for very old patients, but it definitely will make a difference for very young patients. So therefore radiation requirements for children are quite different from radiation requirements in, let's say, 85-year-old patients. And the recommendations by the ICWIC towards the Federal Joint Committee do take this into consideration and may therefore say, for example, this is covered for younger patients, but it is not covered for older patients, because there you do not need this extra precaution. Or it may actually say it is covered by both, but it does. The recommendations are quite specific to patient groups and take into consideration all the available evidence. And when new studies are out, then the directives are changed, taken into consideration the new evidence. And coming up to what John Russell was saying, I think we originally thought if this very complicated and scientifically, let's say, rigorous assessment is done, you want to make it available to as many people and for as many purposes as possible. So therefore, we decided to make the decisions public and to develop patient information from these assessments, because as you all know, there is so much information now available on the internet, but most of the information is fairly low quality. And this information, from a scientific perspective, is fairly high quality and is supported by most of the associations of the physicians. For example, physician association specialty groups are early on involved in the process of generating the evidence. So therefore, why would you not use this information for informing patients or the public at the same time? This answers the question which you said before. You ask, why do we bring this information to bear on so many issues? What patient groups, reimbursement decisions and so forth, even quality control. Because in order to make a good decision at the core of the question, you need to gather information on all different aspects. And if you have this information, you want to use it as long as it is fresh, because you can be sure that in a couple of years, a month, sometimes 2 years or so, you need a full reassessment. So therefore, we make available the information for as many purposes as possible and do the process of, let's say, assessment as rigorously as possible.
Yes, what, you want to identify yourself?
I'm George Greenberg from HHS. I had a question for Kathy, and that is my understanding in the Dutch system that there's, since the enactment of the Health Insurance Act in 2006, there's been a great consolidation of the number of insurers, and that 80% of the population is now insured with four or five insurers only, when previously there were as many as 30. And I'm just wondering if either your authority or the more general competition authority is concerned about that consolidation and the potential threat it has for the general model of competition that you're trying to make work, and whether there are any specific concerns or discussions within the authority or within the government as to what the future direction should be in terms of insurance consolidation in the market.
Okay, shall I try to give an answer? We are not as concerned as you probably think, because we have big four insurance companies, but there are 7 to 10 smaller ones. And from the perspective of the consumer, there is enough choice. On the other hand, the pharmacists, which are very much at discussion at the moment, are complaining about market power of the insurance companies, because of the insurance companies say that they don't like to make a contract to negotiate with every pharmacist on the corner. And the pharmacists are asking for negotiation about price and quality. And that complaint is nowadays in research with our healthcare authority. The population in the Netherlands is a bit concerned, and the providers, also the big providers, have the feeling that the mergers between them has to stop. And we also think that it's enough so. Is this an answer to your question? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Bob Berenson from the Urban Institute. I guess I want to ask Carl and Dominique. It sounds like in both of your systems you now have an association of sickness funds negotiating with providers. In France, it's more recent. How is the representation of the physicians in the hospitals determined? How do they come to the table, and how is that accepted by the diverse set of physicians and hospitals that would be affected?
In Germany, the hospital association basically determines who represents the hospital, and therefore they send the typically the leading four or five experts to the table, and they can exchange experts depending on question. For example, to come up again with the radiation issue, if radiation is the issue, then they will typically come up with two hospital managers that represent the board and two radiation experts. They have seats, but they are not seats that are, let's say, linked to a particular person, so they can exchange the people representing. We want to make sure that the people coming represent their organizations but bring to the table the best available expertise. So therefore we permit the tables to exchange their representatives depending on the issue which is to be negotiated. It's the same with physicians. And for example, if it is an issue of dental care, then dentists will come and not GPs. And if we're speaking an issue about GPs, then GPs will come and not specialists. So the physicians have their own associations, and the associations determine who are the best people representing them on the table for this particular issue in the joint committee.
First, we do not negotiate with hospital physicians, because public hospital physicians are salaried, and they are not exactly civil servants, but almost civil servants. And as I said, one of the problems of our system is that the older hospital part is much more shared between the insurance funds and the state. So basically, we negotiate with private providers who are either in ambulatory care or in private for-profit hospitals. And the unions of these providers, physicians, dentists, nurses, physiotherapists, because we have all these professionals are in independent practice in France, we have processes and rules in order to ensure that the unions, unlike Germany, again, we have a very fragmented representation of providers, very fragmented. It's amazing, man. For nurses, we're discussing with four or five different unions of nurses with different views of what should be done. And for physicians, I mean, we've now a lot of people who have been, because there have been unions at the beginning, and then they didn't agree with each other, that they created a separate union. And basically the rules to be at the table are set by the government, and there is a survey to see whether they have enough they are enough representative of the professionals, they have enough mandants in order to be negotiating. So basically this is the way they are selected. And some of the unions were been declared not representative anymore because they had too few enrollees, and so this is the government is setting these both the rules and the processes to ensure that the unions are representatives of the entire professionals. Once this is done, they come. Some of them may sign, and others may not sign the agreements. So we are not obliged to have all the physician unions, for instance, or hopefully, because otherwise it would be very difficult. We have had some success. For instance, nurses, for the first time, we have an agreement with nurses about the how can I say that? In France, you know, physicians and other professionals can set their practice wherever they want. There is no regulation, territorial regulation. And so we had the first agreement with nurses saying that we would regulate the nurses, because we have very huge discrepancies between territories, and they agreed, all together, all the unions of nurses, that it was a real problem in France and we had to do something together. So we did that by contract and not by regulatory measures. But this we did with all the unions. Sometimes we cannot negotiate with all the unions, so we have only part of them with us.
Let's go right ahead.
Thank you. Diana Dennett with America's Health Insurance Plans. We represent private health insurers here in the U.S. Thank you very, very much for a very informative panel today. My question is really focused particularly on Germany. It's very expensive to do the kind of really in-depth work that you're doing. I'm wondering how... if there are opportunities for collaboration across the EU or how closely you work with the UK in their efforts, and is there any consistency with some of the rulings that you make relative to NICE or other countries? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. From the experience we have, the type of work that are described here is actually very inexpensive. Because if you consider, I mean, we have 150,000 physicians and we have 2,000 hospitals. And these regulations we are speaking about hold for all of them. So if, let's say, 50 or 100 people are working on these central decisions, this is not a large administrative body. I don't know of a single private insurance company not employing more people, despite the fact that this company has no influence on the general scheme to begin with. So, in the cost effectiveness of this investment is obviously, I mean, the return on investment is tremendous. Even a single decision which avoids a test to be used which isn't helpful or so already repays the whole investment. And we are sometimes speaking about major investments here. So I think the costs are not an issue here. On the other hand, there's always good reasons to collaborate with other institutions doing the same work. And this is actually going on. I mean, the researchers working in this field, in the IQWiG, for example, are in touch with the people doing the same work in the Netherlands, in very close collaboration, as a matter of fact, with the Netherlands. And they are, let's say, working together with people in France and with the NICE and with a group in New Zealand and so forth. But this is, let's say, professional collaboration and professional reassurance. This is not meant as a measure of cost containment. And I would also warn everyone to do this, because otherwise the public will feel that decisions about the German healthcare system, the system and what is reimbursed, are somewhere made in England or wherever. So this is or in the U.S., yes. Unthinkable, don't you think so? Yeah, you're absolutely right. So don't spoil the process in making a strategic mistake here in trying to save a couple of thousand dollars.
Yes, did I see people lining up back there? Go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Orland, and I'm a student at the George Washington University, and I'm actually writing a paper on the Dutch healthcare system and how we could use their lessons to reform the U.S. healthcare system. And one of the questions that I had for you was, before 2006, one of the big complaints and problems that the Dutch system had was the fact that the government was competing with private insurers. So I was wondering what you thought about the idea for a public option and how the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives are pushing for this public option, especially in the Democratic Party. And if you think that this sort of government competition will interfere with the prices, make prices of healthcare go up, or if you think that it would be positive?
It's a very good question, and I would like to invite you to the Netherlands. The healthcare authority is not a political body, so I'm not supposed to do any political statements, so I don't think it's wise to answer your question. But as a person, I do think the public option is a possibility in the healthcare competition, because of the public option can set prices in the neighborhood of not in the far distance of the cost prices, and then the competition can go on. So I do think it's a very wise option, but as a person.
Any other persons like to comment on that? All right, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Asit Gosar. I work with McKinsey & Company. I just want to ask about how I can't get a clear sense from you about whether you use negotiation to set prices or do you use regulation to set prices, and whether or not, if you have experience with both, which one has worked better for you in terms of keeping costs low or keeping the cost trend good. Because here in the States, we have a mix of both, and it's unclear whether or not cost plus in Medicare is actually working to control prices or if we should have negotiation instead.
Was the question for me? Or yes?
If you'd like.
Yes, I would like, yes. We do believe, and that's also our experience, that not every market, not every part of the healthcare market is going to be liberated because of the interest, the very huge interest of some markets for the general well-being. For instance, very complicated healthcare for the elderly people, the fragile elderly people. For instance, the severe healthcare of a mental healthcare population. Some parts of it can be liberated, some parts not. And the parts we selected we suggest to do the regulation, but also always in cooperation and communication with the stakeholders. So both are possible and both are indicated, and it depends on which kind of market it is. So, for instance, we are going to liberate the market of the pharmacy in the primary healthcare. We have liberated the physiotherapist care in the primary healthcare. But we don't think it's now an option to liberate the GPs, because of the general interest for a good functioning system, and also we expect that we haven't enough GPs. That's also a very important factor.
Let me just ask Dominique. I just finished reading T.R. Reid's book, and he has this image of a French physician with a price list on his office wall, and he asserts that that price list is the same in every doctor's office in France. That sounds like regulation. Is it, and does it work? And is it accurate?
Oh, well, we have a very strong tradition of regulation of prices in France. I mean, we've been regulating prices for a very long time, and we're still doing that for drugs, for instance, which is not the case in most countries, and also for physicians. I think that our prices are low. That's quite clear. When you look at, the income of our physicians compared to other countries, they're rather low, especially for GPs, but for also part of our specialists. The drug prices have been low for a very long time. The question is that low prices do not exactly ensure efficiency. I mean, it's a little bit different. It has... it may be convenient because it's true that in the French healthcare expenditures, you have very high volumes and rather low prices, obviously compared to your country, for instance. But at the same time, it's not a solution to the challenges that we're facing now. The challenges are to have efficient processes, better quality of care, better cost efficiency in the way we use care, and it's not only a question of prices. So I don't know what to answer to your question. Our prices are reasonably low. If it's the objective, then regulation is not so bad after all. But the problem is that beyond that, we have a lot of other problems to solve.
Just for clarification, because I know from my discussions with American citizens that the German system in one way is often misunderstood. We basically have two systems, the public system and the private system, as I just mentioned. 20% are in the private system, 80% in the public system, and there is a group of about a third of the population which can choose between the two systems, and two-thirds of those who can choose go for the public system, and one-third go into the private system. So it's a kind of an opting-out system. And it is in one way or another is comparable to some of the proposals that you are currently debating in the House and in the Senate. What many people misunderstand is that in the private system in Germany, the prices are actually regulated because there is a state, a government set price list, and in the public system, the prices are negotiated. So it's not the same. So I only say this because I'm very often, confronted with a very important misconception. If the prices were not regulated in the private system, then the private system would be bankrupt very soon in Germany. So the private insurances are now, because their cost, the total cost in the private system are going at twice the speed of the public system. So we have way more, let's say, dynamics, to put it carefully, in the total cost in the private system than in the public system. And the private system is now trying to get a new price list regulated by the government in order to have price control, because they are not in a position to negotiate prices in the way a public system does. And if the prices are fixed in a regulated way, then the providers typically increase volume. And this is why the private system is becoming so expensive in Germany, because if the prices are regulated, physicians very easily can increase volume, and then there is no way for the private system to renegotiate the prices, because the prices are fixed. So if there is no good volume control, and volume control is way more difficult to implement than price control. Whoever thinks that price control is difficult should first think of volume control. Volume control is really difficult. I mean, it's next to impossible. So the private system in Germany suffers from the problem that volume control is next to impossible. We have vast overuse in some of the private sector, and this combined with the price regulation leads to the cost dynamics and price dynamics in the private system.
Very good. We have just a couple of minutes left. Yes, go ahead.
I'll be very quick. I'm Joanne Lynn. I'm with the Department of Health here in the city of Washington. We don't have naturally occurring regions that govern healthcare, and it's very intriguing that most of every other country does. It has some locus that you can point to as the locus of authority for some geography. In your experience in making these things work in regions, what helps make for better as opposed to worse regional governance of healthcare? What kind of data do we need? How big do they need to be? Can you do it for Washington, D.C., or do you need to have the whole metro area? It could be the size of states, or does it need to be smaller? What's the accumulated wisdom of how a region could integrate its healthcare system? And, of course, now Ed's only going to give you 2 minutes to answer.
I don't think I'm the person who can answer this question, because the Netherlands are very, very small.
perhaps a province of Germany, and we don't have the regional level, so we don't have experience with that, so I can't answer your question.
How about, Dominique, you talked about regionalization.
Yeah, we think that some things are better done at the national level and some things are really better done at the regional or local level, because there's not only one territory that could do everything. We have chosen the region as the, well, the second level of management of the system, because we think that in given the size of the French regions, we have 22 regions, we have 64 million inhabitants, they have the full spectrum of supply, and they are responsible. What the region can do that the national level cannot do is to be sure that on each point of the territory there is the supply available for people, that there is the access, geographical access to care, that there is, for instance, the hospital in as you were saying this morning, Carl, the hospital A and the hospital B, are they doing the same thing than trying to compete with the same activities, or shouldn't they try to cooperate and maybe do the surgery in one place and do the medicine in another place? Wouldn't that be more efficient? And of course, all these are stakeholders which are independent from each other, and the role of the region in that area is to try to organize care in the best possible way, and to, especially since our medical demography is declining now, so we're beginning to have some holes in the territory with, for instance, some places where we lack GPs also. We have to have specific policies to try to retain people and so on. This has to be done at the regional or local level. Regional doesn't mean that there is no local level. They might also work with smaller offices in the region. But this cannot be done at the national level. So basically, this is the idea. Now, there is another... what is more debatable is, should they be responsible for everything? And this is more or less what has been done in the last legislation. And then they have a lot of levers. So the idea would be probably that they would be really the one to regulate the system within each region with a national framework. This would be at the regional or the national level. I think that both would be, this is more debatable. But for the geography of care, obviously we need some territorial level.
Robin, you want to...
I just wanted to pick up on a question that John had raised in talking about an independent Medicare advisory commission and it being discussed in terms of experts, and compare that to the models in your countries, and particularly in terms of public involvement. So the Federal Joint Committee, as I understand it, includes patients, providers, payers, and to get a sense of what the patient public role is, and similarly in terms of some of the other structures in the Netherlands and France, what role is there for public representation, and how effectively does that really work?
We regularly have contact and meetings with several patients' organizations, and we always try to think from their perspective, and we also test that with them. And they are very content till now, because of they have the feeling that we are really doing a good job for them. But ultimately, they have to participate on the advisory commissions, but they don't like it. It's very technical, and most of the time they don't understand what the issues are about and what their added value should be. So we are searching for a modus that is satisfactory to both of the parties, the three of the parties. So we have not a final solution, but it's continuously on the agenda. Is that an answer to your question?
Yes.
Dominique, did you want to respond
well,
to that?
In France, the National Authority for Health is, as a scientific basis, but works a lot with providers on one hand and patients' association on the other hand. So they are gathering commissions to discuss the different aspects that, for instance, let me give you an example. We have these 30 diseases for which people are exempted for copayments, and we had asked the National Health Authority to tell us how to what kind of protocols of care could be delivered to these patients, and with both the idea of having better quality but also limiting the 100% reimbursement to this needed care, and that's it. And so they had for the commissions for examining the data on these diseases, and they invited patients associations, invited the different professional association to debate on these on each of these diseases. So they involved them a lot in the debate. Then afterwards, they give an advice on the basis of expertise, but also on the basis of the testimony of these different stakeholders.
And let me turn to Carl for the last comment on the last question, and as I do, ask you to take this opportunity while you're listening to his wonderful answer to fill out that blue evaluation form. Thank you. Go ahead, Carl.
I think that the patient evaluation or the participation is incredibly important for the credibility of the whole process, because in medicine, many decisions or let's say many medical beliefs are plausible but false. And whenever something is plausible but false, there is a risk that people believe that what is not done for cost containment reasons, whilst the truth is it doesn't work. I'll give you one example. Breast cancer screening for those younger, for women younger than 50. It is very plausible that it should work for those younger than 50. If it works for those women older than 50, it's plausible. If it works for older women, it should definitely work for younger women. But it's unfortunately false, because the studies do not show a survival benefit for younger women. And we made this decision not to cover screening on a routine basis. This is not speaking about women with extra risk factors and so forth. But on a routine basis, we made this decision with the involvement of the patient groups. And the credibility of the whole process was much higher than if we would have done exactly the same without their involvement. So without involving the patients in the process of the decision-making process, in the process of the decision-making, it is very difficult to get the acceptability and the credibility of the decisions that are made, in particular in the large subgroup of issues where something is plausible but false.
Okay. Well, we've come. Oh, go ahead.
Because I'm a little bit challenged about what you're saying, because in France, it looks as if everybody could agree on what to choose and what not to choose. But in France, if you do cost effectiveness, then you will have for some treatments the fact that yes, they may add some small benefit, but at such a cost that it's effective but not efficient. It seemed to me that you had both on your slide, but then, for instance, in France, it's very difficult for patient associations to admit that something could not be done on the basis of efficiency. They would admit if it was totally, totally non-effective. But a lot of things are more complicated than that. I mean, very effective for very marginal benefits, and then they are not really efficient. It seems that you had only, white or black things in your decisions, and it surprised me.
Well, so far, I'll respond to this directly. So far, we have not turned down a single service for cost-effectiveness reasons. We have only looked at effectiveness. Because
okay,
I think...
The same, then. We do the same.
Because typically what happens is that a service for the right group is effective, and if it is effective, then typically it's also cost-effective. And the services, I mean, there is a very small segment of, let's say, services that are effective but clearly not cost-effective. And if you focus, for example, the breast cancer screening issue, here the issue is not the cost-effectiveness, but simply that there is no studies showing a survival benefit for women without risk factors at these younger age groups. I'm not... sure that in the long run, cost-effectiveness will not become a more important issue. And if it becomes a more important issue, I think then it is even more important to have patients involved in order to, let's say, defend the credibility of the process. Because if the patients are no longer in the process at the very moment when cost considerations come in to play a role, the credibility of the process will not be defensible.
All right. Thank you so much. As you're filling out those blue evaluation forms, listen to me say that I want to thank the Commonwealth Fund, Robin Osborne and her colleagues, for making this event possible and supporting and providing us with much of our grist for the discussion. Thank you for being with us, and thank our panelists, in which I would hope you would join me, for enlightening a number of U.S. domestic situations in light of international experience. Thank you all.